WikiLeaks says that someone is trying to silence its founder, Julian Assange, as he vows to release tens of thousands of new emails that he says will sink Hillary Clinton's campaign.
The United Nations and aid agencies are very worried about what could end up being a humanitarian disaster when it comes to the number of people fleeing. They say they're preparing for what they're describing as the worst case scenario, where up to 1 million people could end up escaping Mosul.
Disney princesses, Frozen, and Trolls dolls helped Hasbro deliver better than expected revenue and profit in the third quarter. Net revenue in the girls' toys segment jumped almost 60%, overshadowing slower growth in the boys' segment, Hasbro's biggest business.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to The Opening Bell on this Tuesday. It's October 18th, 2016, 5:09, almost 5:10 in the morning. Glad to have you along for another edition of The Opening Bell, another business day. Lots to talk about this morning. Earnings season in full steam. We'll tell you about some local companies and their earnings that have been posted. And we'll have a discussion this morning, a conversation about wasted food. How much is wasted? What you can do to stem the tide? You'll never believe how much food is wasted in America, but there are some solutions, and we'll get to that right after we get to the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk this morning. First, to the Dow futures in this country. Dow futures are pointing toward opening gains later this morning, up 73 points this morning. S&P and NASDAQ futures are a little bit higher as well. As you heard Vic give you an update there on some of the world markets, European markets are generally higher this morning as well. So are Asian markets. In Europe, the DAX is leading the way, up almost a full percent, with the CAC right behind at, again, up almost a full percent. The FTSE also doing well this morning. In Asia, all of the markets are doing generally well. The Hang Seng up almost a percent and a half, so is the Shanghai. Markets are generally performing well around the globe this morning as we move toward the opening bell in the United States later on today. Some news making, business banking news this morning as we get up and get going. Some of the day ahead will feature an update of Social Security and retiree information. This is what benefits can be expected next year. Today is an important day as lots of people live on this cost of living adjustment, the COLA, and it'll affect more than 70 million people. They'll find out again today what that is. Later this morning. Yesterday, some big news from United Continental, Chicago-based United Continental, reporting earnings down 80% in third quarter. This based mostly on a one-time tax and lower revenue. United reporting this $545 million in tax payment and another $965 million in net income for just July, August, and September. That's down about $4.8 billion from the same period a year earlier. It'll be interesting as we go through the morning, as we hear analysts discuss and dice this as to just what is at play with United. But they're not alone in this. Some of the other airlines are also seeing weakening markets and weakening revenues as well as we move into the last part of the year. On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk this morning, some stocks of local interest. We mentioned United Airlines loss in the last quarter, their performance. Their stock is just a little bit lower pre-market this morning. McDonald's is also about a percent and a half lower this morning. Mondelez International is just a few ticks lower this morning. Sears Holding is up almost a full percent pre-market this morning at 5:21.
From ABC News, Wall Street Now. Stocks kicked off the week with losses as investors await a busy week of earnings reports. The Dow Jones dropped 52 points. The Standard & Poor's 500 was off 6. The NASDAQ fell 14 points. More than 80 companies in the S&P 500 report their earnings this week. Netflix beat forecasts for subscriber additions in the last quarter, mainly in international markets where the streaming service added 3.2 million new customers. That news sent shares soaring 20% in after-hours trading. Millions of Social Security recipients and federal retirees will get only tiny increases in benefits next year, the fifth year in a row that older Americans will have to settle for historically low raises. Next year's benefits hike will be small because inflation is low. And striking Jim Beam workers sit down again today with management. One of the biggest complaints at the world's largest bourbon maker is not money, but time. The union wants to see more full-time employees rather than temporary workers at the distillery. Jim Ryan, ABC News.
So how much food do you think is wasted every year in America? If I told you billions and billions of tons, would you believe that? Hundreds of millions of tons, perhaps? Balan Lineken is the author of a new book called Biting the Hand That Feeds Us. He has written extensively about this and says it's time to think about wasted food in a new way, especially since one in five homes in America are what we are describing as food insecure. That means there are some days there's no food at all, other days when there are. We've had the opportunity to interview Balan Lineken. He's with us today on Skype. Again, the book is called Biting the Hand That Feeds Us. Balan, first let's talk about how significant this problem is. You've written about it in this book, but you've also been reporting on this for many years. How significant is this problem?
It's infuriating and it's frustrating. As I write in the book, it's as a result both of, our own misbehavior. We waste 40% of our food, but also because of a myriad of government rules that, frankly, oftentimes make it easier for people to throw away food or cheaper to do so than to save it or to provide it to those who might need it.
Give us a sense of how significant this problem is. How much food goes to waste every year in America?
It's in the hundreds of billions of pounds. I think it's something like $150 billion plus. We have school systems that are wasting. I think Los Angeles calculated that they're wasting almost $20 million a year in their school system in food waste. And just to sort of compound it, the problem isn't just that, here's some food and it wasn't eaten, but that food often ends up in landfills. And it's one of the most significant contributors to greenhouse gases on the planet. As I note in the book, if food waste were a country, it would be number three behind China and the United States in terms of contribution to greenhouse gas emissions.
It's mind-boggling to think about that. Again, thinking about how many people go hungry every day. Is it all kinds of food? Is it produce? Is it food that's being made at restaurant? Is it, or does it cover all of it?
Really, I think it runs the gamut. I mean, I'm guilty. I'm generally really good at cleaning my plate at home. Plenty of people throw their food scraps away or throw it down the garbage disposal rather than composting or just serving what they think they and others might eat. Restaurants certainly waste tons, literally tons of food. And, we're all playing a part in this. And I guess the upside is that if we change our behavior, then we can make a significant difference.
And that is something, as an agriculture area here in Illinois, we do a lot of farm reporting and agriculture reporting. And our farm reporters will always say that as we move further into the future, it's going to be harder and harder to feed everybody. But it's kind of hard to believe that when we see how much food is being thrown away. I mean, what can we do immediately to sort of stop turn this tide?
It is an interesting question. The population's going from 7 to 8 to 9 and I guess maybe to $11 billion by the end, or 11 billion people rather, by the end of this century. The bright spot, I guess, is that we are wasting all this food, which is a silver lining. We're obviously producing enough food for that many people right now. And if we can become more efficient production-wise, and I'm absolutely sure that we will, because humans innovate and become more efficient generally. So that's one way. But as I point out in the book, there are plenty of government rules that encourage food waste, and so that's the angle I'm taking: is that food safety, food waste, other issues like that. The government needs to stop encouraging these wasteful and bad behaviors, and it needs to actually, even if not incentivize, but just let people stop wasting food, because our inclination is largely not to. And we've sort of been complacent about that for a long time.
Give us an example of some of these things that you're talking about. Like, for instance, with regulation, with the government, give us an idea of what is at play here.
Sure. I think a great example of rules that encourage food waste are USDA rules around grading of produce and meats. So, you know, when you go to the store, you might see grade A eggs or number one carrots or fancy apples or choice beef. These are all designations that are awarded thanks to largely the work of the food industry working with the USDA to sort of establish these purely aesthetic standards. They have nothing to do with the quality of the food or the safety of the food or the flavor of the food, but just, you know, do they fit these sort of metrics for how food, you know, as determined by industry and the government, quote unquote, should look. That's why when you go to the grocery store, you see a 1 pound or a 2 pound or a 5 pound bag of number one carrots. They're all uniform in diameter. I think they have to be at least 3/4 of an inch to earn that number one designation. But, you know, what happens to the number two or the number three carrots? Those are generally left in the fields. People don't pick them because they're not going to be compensated. Farmers just leave them behind and they, you know, they're food waste that never even makes it to the store. When you go to the farmer's market, if you do, then you'll see that there are weirdly shaped carrots that sometimes look like little people, you know, or aliens, or they're very, very oddly shaped. They turn out also to taste fantastic because they're bred for flavor rather than for this sort of uniform aesthetic. And so this is, you know, nothing in the USDA rules prohibits people from purchasing carrots that are oddly shaped, but, you know, consumer expectations, grocers trying to meet those expectations, and producers working with the government to establish the rules of the game are what does cause something like 1/3 of the food that's grown to be wasted in this country just in the fields.
You write about how these are considered the ugly fruits and vegetables. They're still delicious, right?
Oh, they're spectacular. I talk about a group that I checked out when I was in Portugal a couple of summers ago. Their name literally is Ugly Fruit, Fruta Feia in Portuguese. And they're working with farmers there to try to make sure that the farmers can sell their misshapen fruit, and also that people in the country, which has been hit hard by a recession in recent years, can afford to buy fruit and vegetables. And so, you know, they're pulling the produce out of the fields. They're paying the farmers something like half of what they would have gotten from the market, and they're providing it in the equivalent of CSA boxes for their customers. It's a wonderful thing. And when I met with Maria Canellas, who's a woman who works for Fruta Feia, she brought me some grapes and some melons that were, you know, didn't meet the EU rules, because the EU has rules that are similar to those that the USDA has in this country. And they were spectacular. I mean, they were just wonderful. And, you know, so I make a point to, if I'm buying carrots, to try to go to my farmer's market and to try to seek out those that otherwise might go to waste. And, you know, it's a nice way to reduce food waste, but it's also a nice way to get some food that's interesting looking and that tastes wonderful.
You write in your book that there's a myriad of different laws. Many of them probably are not needed. And you write that perhaps we could get along with fewer regulations and fewer rules when it comes to our food.
Yeah, it's a different way of looking at sustainability. Most oftentimes, people who support sustainability think, you know, this is something that needs a lot of rules to support it. And you'll find other people who also believe that sustainability is something that require a lot of rules. And, you know, they're sort of the more conservative and libertarian types who, you know, who might think like, oh, this whole sustainability thing is just a code for, you know, we need more rules and more funding and more tax dollars. And my book, I think, is an excellent counterpoint to both of those arguments that, you know, we do need some rules. The book isn't an argument for some sort of food anarchy. But that so many of the rules that we currently have on the books today are just at loggerheads with the whole notion of sustainability.
One of the examples is happened here near Chicago, a cherry farm over in Michigan. Tell us about that and how this cherry grower had to throw away his entire crop.
Yeah, this is, a USDA program that is just bizarre and wasteful. There's a similar rule around raisins, and there are plenty of rules around there's spearmint oil and other things. So tart cherries are subject to, I think, they're grown in like 7 states, Michigan being one of them. And the rules basically were established for the first time during the New Deal era as a way to try to prop up, to limit the supply, to prop up prices, and to get farmers a better return on their investment. You know, farmers were struggling during the Depression. This, you know, may have been a sensible approach now. Farmers, you know, for the most part, are actually doing pretty well now. And this was supposed to be a sort of a short-term solution. Well, essentially what these programs do in many cases is say, you know, regardless of how much, let's say, cherries we've produced, you need to keep some percentage out of the marketplace, and you can't donate them, you can't sell them. There are no real end arounds. And so what many people have to do, including this this cherry handler in Michigan, is just throw them out. Tons of cherries. This farmer posted on Facebook a photo of, you know, essentially like a dumpster sized pile of cherries that he had to throw out because of the law. And it's obviously creating food waste, but it's more importantly, it's stifling innovation. You know, what if the farmer could figure out some other way to market those cherries, or has better cherries than others. And so, you know, these slip of the tongue there, called them problems, but, you know, they're programs that are problems, that really don't serve anyone's interests and have so many unintended negative consequences.
And this goes beyond agriculture too. There's an example of fishermen and how they're required in some cases to throw fish back into the ocean. I mean, so it cuts across all different areas of our food supply, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. I mean, there are many good things about the laws that regulate our fisheries. The Magnuson-Stevens Act is the primary rule, but as you point out, the rules do in some cases force fishermen to the tune of hundreds of thousands of pounds a year to throw out fish that they very easily could bring back to shore and sell. Those fish are going to die in the ocean. So what's going to happen? They simply need to catch more fish. So you're killing the fish twice. You know, you're killing the ones that you caught and can't bring to shore, and then you have to catch more to try to you know, meet your quota. And it's a backwards approach. And I do point out in a few cases there are some trial programs with, say, environmental groups and fishermen to try to figure out sort of better ways of managing fisheries while not overfishing, also not causing fish to go to waste.
There's some other parts of the world that they're working to solve this problem, or at least move to solving the problem. Here in the United States, sometimes, you know, restaurants can't give away food. But in other countries, we see that these programs are working. There's an app, I think, that's been developed where restaurants give away their you know, excess food at the end of the day. And in some places, it's actually become the law, right?
Yeah, France, I think, was the first country to mandate, and at least in the EU, that there not be waste. And it's interesting because French culture has been sort of resistant to the whole idea of le doggy bag historically, but now it's the law. I'm not sure that, you know, it could be that people just bring their food home and throw it away there, and so that's not necessarily a solution, but certainly prohibiting people from taking the food home, which I think the French did, was pretty ludicrous. So, I mean, there are ways there, you know, people, I think, their inclination is not to waste, because it costs money and, you know, people generally don't want to see trash around, whether it's food or otherwise. I think the best rules are ones that allow people to live more sustainably without infringing on their rights or their livelihood or frankly their home.
And so what can we do to help in this matter? If we're getting ready, you know, with our breakfast or lunch or whatever, can we do something at home to help? Can we get involved with, you know, helping this bigger movement? How can we not feel hopeless?
Yeah, it's difficult. I think that first of all, you know, some of the changes that I've already suggested are ones that people can and should make. Stop wasting food. You know, stop making so much food. Stop, therefore wasting it. And you know, leftovers are a wonderful thing, as I describe in the book, for kids, for sending them off to school, for school lunch. So that's, you know, those are things that we can and should do at home, and you can, you know, share food. I do note in the book that there are many cities around the country that penalize sharing food with the homeless and less fortunate, pushing back against those laws and against all the other bad laws that I talk about in the book, making sure that your local, state, and federal lawmakers hear from you when you learn that there's a law that's prohibiting people from having a garden in their yard, or that's put your sustainable local meat producer out of business because of some arcane rules that don't make food any safer. Being angry and sharing that anger with your lawmaker through a telephone call or a visit or an email can make an enormous difference. And I hope this book encourages people to begin to speak out about some of these rules.
Often in journalism, we say follow the money, and it's generally you can find money that leads to bad behavior in legislation. But in this case, it seems like nobody's really even given a second thought to it. It's just throwing money after money. And is that what you're finding too, that it's not really, nobody's really profiting from this?
Well, I mean, in some cases, yes, certainly. Chapter two of the book is it talks about how, quote unquote, big food is in bed with, quote unquote, big government. And I use farm subsidies as sort of the best example of that. And farm subsidies, you know, are essentially funds that are taken from you and me and given to farmers these days to help, pay their crop insurance premiums. These are, insurance is a wonderful thing. I have nothing against insurance, but, I'm not asked to pay your car insurance premiums, and nor should I be. And I shouldn't also be asked to pay for farmer's insurance. If it turns out that we have to pay more at the grocery store, then so be it. A market system where we're competing against one another is a far better solution. So, farm subsidies are definitely one example where there is sort of an entrenched interest that that is looking for handouts from the government, and those handouts are not only exist but are growing every year.
Certainly, this is an eye-opening topic, a very interesting book. Thank you for bringing it to our attention, and hopefully we can make some difference.
Thanks so much for having me on, Steve. I really appreciate it.
Bela Linekan is the author of Biting the Hand That Feeds Us, a book about food waste in the U.S. You can find it at Amazon.com and at bookstores now, where it is currently on sale. Again, Bela Linekan, The Biting the Hand That Feeds Us. 5:30 on WGN, the opening bell. Vic Vaughn standing by in the newsroom. The news coming up, Vic.
Coming up, we could see charges this morning in a shooting that led to a Chicago campus lockdown yesterday, Steve. That report coming up next.
All right, this is the opening bell.
From ABC News Tech Trends, I'm Alex Stone, a big vehicle maker getting into the car sharing business. Those who live in some big cities have come to know car sharing. You borrow a car for as long as you need it. There are no people involved, no signing paperwork. An app shows you where the car is parked. You hop in it, drive it, drop it off, and the app charges you a fee. Now General Motors is getting in the game. It has its own car sharing business. It's calling Maven. It just launched in San Francisco after some test markets. Dan Grossman is a COO of Maven.
We've loaded these cars up. These cars have everything you'd want.
In fact, the vehicles are brand new and they have everything in them, including 4G Wi-Fi. Borrowing a Maven vehicle can cost as low as $8 an hour, and you can keep it for up to 4 days. GM pays for the gas and insurance.
I see this going everywhere.
It's a win-win for GM. They make money off the car sharing, and it lets more people drive GM vehicles to maybe one day down the road buy one. With Tech Trends, I'm Alex Stone, ABC News.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is the Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. It's 540. 17 million new home buyers expected to enter the housing market over the next 5 years. This is according to some new research out from TransUnion. Joining us this morning from the company is one of its senior research analysts and a study co-writer, Nidhi Verma, is with us. Nidhi, good morning. Welcome to the Opening Bell.
Good morning to you, Steve, and good morning to all your listeners this morning.
Let's talk about this, because I've heard recently that the supply of housing is not equal to the number of people who might be seeking it. If you could give us a sense of where things stand now, is there available housing for all these people entering the home market?
Well, I can't speak so much about the housing stock supply in terms of new homes and existing homes, but I can certainly speak from a demand perspective that we are projecting about 3 million first-time home buyers to come in the market in the next year, which actually looks about 17 million when you look in the next 5 years. And that takes into account consumers who are younger consumers who are entering the market at much faster pace than we've seen in the past. To give you an example, these younger consumers are between the ages of 20 to 39, and they represent, Steve, about 40% of new first-time home buyers entering as of the end of 2015. When you compare that 60% to what it looked like back even in 2000, which was 15 years ago, that number was just about 44% of the first-time home buyers were in the younger segment. So really there is a demand definitely bolstered by the strong fundamentals of our economy, demand bolstered by strong wage and salary growth, as well as consumers being employed, which is very healthy for the credit economy.
And that's what I wanted to get into next, is what you saw as driving the numbers of going up as this research shows. What you mentioned a couple of things, the economy. What else?
Sure. So fundamentals of the economy are always going to be the foundation. And really important on top of that is we've built a propensity model using trended data. Trended data allows us to look at consumers over up to 30 months of their historical behavior and identify very unique credit characteristics for consumers who are going to become first-time homebuyers versus consumers who are not going to participate in the mortgage market. By being able to distinguish that and truly identify those eligible consumers, we're able to project with a great degree of certainty who these consumers will be in the next few years. So that's really the propensity model. Its self-prediction indicates that. And along with that, I think what you have to keep in mind is the long-term projections of the purchase market in the mortgage sector, which are definitely very strong, again, bolstered by the economic fundamentals, as well as just looking at the share of these first-time home buyers increasing as portion of your government and agency mortgages.
Does this say anything about the, on a flip side of this, does the number of people, especially younger people, entering the home market say anything about the strength of the economy? I know that, that one might be driving the other, but what does it say about the strength of the economy?
Yeah, so the way we measure the strength of the economy is certainly by looking at your key fundamentals, such as the GDP growth and the unemployment rate. But if you compare two very different economic periods, which would be the end of 2000, the year of the end of 2000, which again was, you know, 16 years ago, and certainly we were in a very strong position as an economy, and you compare that to where we are at the end of 2015, which we've certainly recovered from the last recession, you compare those 2 years and you look at a subsegment of the ages of 20 to 29 in that first-time homebuyer market, that number has gone from 17% of the contribution to up to 28% of the contribution. So unlike most conventional wisdom that younger consumers are not buying homes or younger consumers are not participating in the mortgage market, our analysis, our study actually shows quite the opposite, which is even the youngest subsegment of the first-time homebuyers coming in. The reason that tells us the strength of the economy is the fact that these consumers are certainly employed and coming in. Now, certainly from a credit perspective, credit score perspective, these are stronger consumers than, generally speaking, your non-home buyers. That also is a great sign of what I would call a recovered economy.
And so you can, your research goes that far down. You can actually see the credit scores of, or project the credit scores of some of these folks, and they're good credit risks.
Absolutely. 90% or more of these consumers are in your prime and above Vantage score segments. These are the consumers who certainly are eligible, risk eligible for new mortgages. And that number has actually gone up over the 15-year period that we studied between 2000 and 2015. And certainly you would expect that to go up, to your point earlier, from a recovered economy. As consumers are more confident about the economy, they're getting access to credit, and they're actually paying down their credit as well, that certainly will enable them to be in those better risk tiers. And we are seeing definitely a significant portion of these consumers being in those higher credit scores that certainly makes them even more eligible as a first-time home buyer. It's also important to... Yeah, please go ahead.
No, I was just going to say one of the negatives here might be that they're jumping in just as the Federal Reserve is starting to move toward a period of raising interest rates. So if the Federal Reserve, as everybody expects, starts in December and considers and continues that upward trend, that might be a negative for these new home buyers, right?
Interest rates significantly impact the refinance market. There's encouragement and discouragement as interest rates move up and down for those who are looking to refinance their existing mortgages. When it comes to first-time home buyers, there are many relief programs as well as many support programs from a tax perspective that are available to these consumers that really allows them to be able to get into their first home. And also, not to mention, now that we're using trended data in the underwriting of Fannie Mae loans, that trended data would allow these consumers to get into even better rates. Just by using that trended data, some of these consumers can actually see a benefit of tens and thousands of dollars in interest amount that they will pay on these new mortgages. So while there might be some downward impact from an interest rate perspective on the refinance market, but from a purchase perspective, these first-time home buyers would certainly see some benefits, both with the use of trended data as well as the strong economy.
New research shows 17 million new home buyers expected to enter the housing market over the next 5 years. Nidhi Verma, TransUnion Senior Director of Research and a study co-writer. Thanks for being with us this morning, Nidhi.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
552, welcome back to the program on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk this morning. Dow futures pointing solidly toward gains when the bell rings later this morning, up 73 points right now. S&P and NASDAQ futures higher as well. Let's get the latest now on commodities and agriculture. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. An interesting day in the marketplace yesterday. Good news in the grain market, not good news in the livestock market. First of all, let's look at the USDA weekly crop harvest report. Corn harvest, 46% complete nationally. That's behind the five-year average of 49%. The soybean harvest, 62% complete, pretty much in line with the five-year average. But when we take a look at some of the states in corn harvest, take a look at Illinois, because Illinois is showing 73% of the corn crop harvested. Iowa, only 33%, and Indiana, 52%. When we take a look at soybean harvest, well, there Iowa's ahead with 62%, followed by Illinois, 58%, Indiana, 54%. Soybeans got a boost yesterday from the sharp increase in oilseed prices, particularly canola oil, and the report on soybean exports, 2.5 million tons, well above the highest estimate of 1.6 million. Now, the bad news, and I won't spend much time on it, but hog prices yesterday hit 14-year lows for the nearby contract. On the other hand, a little bit of recovery again in the cattle market yesterday, technical buying coming in. Today, opening day at Sunbelt Expo at Moultrie, Georgia. Tomorrow, opening day of the four-day National FFA Convention in Indianapolis. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You have a great day as well. Now, the Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for Tuesday, October 18th. This morning, the National Association of Home Builders Housing Market Index is released. Also, later this morning, the U.S. Labor Department releases the Consumer Price Index for September. We also find out today the Social Security cost of living adjustments. We fully expect those to be about 1% of what they have been over the last few years. This COLA adjustment affects more than 70 million people. That's about 1 in 5 Americans. Preliminary numbers suggest, again, a COLA of less than 1%, according to an analysis by experts and by the Associated Press. All of these things could drive the markets today. Also among quarterly earnings set for release before the market opens today, United Healthcare Group, Johnson & Johnson, Philip Morris International, Goldman Sachs. Yahoo reports its quarterly financial results after the market closes today. One other note before we leave you today. I'm sure we've all enjoyed Culver's ice cream or Butter Burger at some point in our lives. The company is mourning the loss of its CEO this morning. Philip Kaiser has died. The Wisconsin restaurant company has announced Kaiser died on Saturday of natural causes, just a few days before his birthday. His 61st birthday would have been yesterday. A statement from the Culver's restaurant says the entire Culver's community is devastated. Phil Kaiser, one of the leading minds behind the restaurant's success in recent years, the CEO of Culver's, dead at the age of 60.